Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston. Senator, thanks for getting up with me this morning. And I know this is kind of your pit stop on the way before you do the hustle up the Hancock this morning.
Yes, thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me. And my own little demonstration that words matter is that when I was asked months ago whether I would run up the Hancock Tower to help raise money for the Respiratory Health Association, back then it sounded like a great idea, and I said yes, and now I've got a lot of climbing to do later on this morning.
Well, so but you could be like others. You could say, well, that was fake news when you said it, right?
I could. I think that only works for one or two elected officials in this country.
Understood. Well, I wanted to thank you for joining me this morning. And actually, first, given the fact of the election of the new Democratic National Chairman, Tom Perez, the former Labor Secretary, and, you know, a lot of people saw this election as kind of a proxy battle of the old Hillary Clinton establishment, the Obama establishment, versus the Bernie Sanders and the progressive with Keith Ellison. Just wanted to get your thoughts on the direction of the party.
Yeah, thanks for asking. And I'll tell you, I was supporting Keith Ellison for DNC chair because of what you said, that I felt that there was a troubling rift in the party, that a lot of Sanders supporters didn't feel as included in the party as they should and as the party needs to make them felt. And I thought that having Keith Ellison, a vocal Sanders supporter, leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, as the DNC chair would help bring folks in. The good news is that Tom Perez is also a progressive. He was an excellent labor secretary, not just a good one, an excellent labor secretary who did a series of important things for workers, for the progressive movement in the Obama administration. And he also, immediately after being narrowly elected DNC chair, moved to make Keith Ellison the deputy chair. And so I think he shares many, many, many values with Ellison, Sanders, and their supporters, and also understands the urgent need for party unity in this difficult moment where Donald Trump is president of the United States and the Democratic Party is really, in a lot of respects, the only thing standing between Donald Trump and making dangerous moves that would harm this country for not just years, but decades and generations.
Well, and some have suggested that if there is a unifying, one unifying theme for Democrats that might be somewhat disparate is Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I feel like I've become almost a professional protester recently. The Women's March, of course, was an incredible experience here in downtown Chicago on the 21st of January, the day after the inauguration. But there have been a series of demonstrations and protests and actions and organizing efforts on a almost daily basis since then. And as I go from event to event, from rally to rally, and work with group after group after group, what I find is there's an awful lot of people in those crowds who were passionate supporters of Bernie Sanders in the primary. There's an awful lot of people in those crowds who were supporters of Hillary Clinton in the primary, and they're unified not only in their terror at the disastrous and immoral and un-American things Donald Trump is doing, but also in their vision for a better country with economic and social justice. And so I think this is an opportunity for Democrats to unify around core principles, to unify in opposition to something dangerous, and to step forward as a single united front.
But is this something that is sustainable?
What I tell groups that I meet with is we can't know what Donald Trump is going to say tomorrow or next month or 6 months from now. What we can know, what we do know, is that we have to stay active and united because there is a great likelihood that something dangerous will be coming out of the White House in 6 months. And so I told people the day after the Women's March, today we're active, tomorrow we're active, next week we're more active. And I say that every day when I speak with more groups. And what I've seen so far is that the energy is growing, the passion is expanding, and people understand that we need to be in this for the long haul. This is not a couple demonstrations in January of 2017 to blow off steam. This is the building of a movement that'll have to sustain itself through 2017 and beyond to transform our country. I think we can do it. But it's going to take a lot of effort and organizing to make that happen.
I forget who the pundit was who said that, you know, here we are, you know, just over a month, and it's that the public is aging faster than the president is, for a change.
Well, I'm certainly not aging slowly, but I'm also not going to get tired, I'll tell you that much.
You do have legislation that that takes a poke at Donald Trump, legislation that requires any presidential candidate who wants to be on the Illinois ballot that has to release 5 years of their tax returns.
You bet. Listen, I think the country right now is going through something a little bit scary, where we have a president who was not willing to release his tax returns and who, therefore, we don't know much about his finances. Well, that means two things, Rick. First of all, it means that he ran on this platform of saying, hey, look, I'm the great businessman. You should support me because I'll be a good businessman for America the way I was for myself. Well, we haven't seen his tax returns. We don't really know how good a businessman he was. But more importantly than that, there are potential conflicts of interest across this administration, including in its foreign dealings with other countries. And because we don't have access to information about the president's finances, we can't really know for sure about those things. That is dangerous for the country and potentially unconstitutional because of the Emoluments Clause of the United States Constitution. So for decades, we've had a broad tradition that presidential candidates of both parties release their tax returns, even candidates like Mitt Romney, for whom that was kind of embarrassing. Well, Donald Trump refused to do that, and what that told me is that it shouldn't just be a tradition, it should be the law. So I have Senate Bill 982, which says that you can't appear on the ballot for president in Illinois unless you've released 5 years of tax returns. I think it's likely to get a committee hearing this coming week in Springfield, and I hope we can pass it into law because I sure wish it had been the law when the 2016 election happened.
But is it really constitutional? I mean, can a state set up a qualification for office that doesn't exist in the U.S. Constitution?
I think so, and here's why. The state cannot say, here's a qualification you must have. Here's a thing you have to be in order to run. So, for example, the U.S. Constitution says that if you want to run for Congress, you have to live in the state, but you don't necessarily have to live in the district. Some states have tried to pass laws saying, oh, no, wait, you do have to live in the district, and those laws have been struck down because those laws say you must be a certain type of person, that's to say a resident of the district, in order to run. What states can do is say, hey, listen, the U.S. Constitution says what type of person you must be. We're going to say what you must do to appear on the ballot. So we're going to say, for example, you have to file a certain number of signatures to appear on the ballot. Illinois does that. That's constitutional. Other states say you have to pay a filing fee. That's constitutional when those states do that. And so what we're saying is not you have to have a particular thing in your tax returns, just you must make the decision to release them. And so I think that's consistent with saying you got to have a certain number of signatures, saying you have to file a certain type of paperwork. I believe it would be upheld by the court, and I think it's a good idea.
And would create a lot more work for those of us when it comes to presidential filing time here in Illinois.
I'm here to help, Rick.
I appreciate it. State Senator Dan Biss from Evanston. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue, joined by State Senator Daniel Biss, Democrat from Evanston. Senator, the Senate, after a week break, comes back into session on Tuesday, I believe. And there's been a lot of discussion about the grand bargain, the so-called grand bargain, the effort by the leaders of both parties in the state Senate to try to find some way for compromise to get through the state's historic lack of a budget. And I'm curious if you think this process is actually going to get there at some point. Republican leader Christine Rodonio had said we need to vote by the end of the month, really, to show that the Senate means business in trying to get things done. What happens on Tuesday?
Yeah, that's right. She said we have to vote by the end of the month. That is this Tuesday, and that's the next session day, so there's a real short window there. Let's back up for a second, Rick. The state hasn't had a budget. Well, by the end of this month, it'll have been 20 months that the state doesn't have a full budget. That's insanity. There's no state that's ever been in that situation before. The consequences for social service providers, for the mentally ill, for individuals who are victims of domestic abuse, for universities, community colleges, students, are horrific. And simultaneously, by the way, we're running up on another $11 million of debt every day while not funding these services. So it's an absurd situation that is dangerous and damaging and unnecessary. And so Senate President Cullerton and Republican Senate Leader Redonio have been sitting down and trying to work out a compromise, like almost as if they were rational adults who wanted to solve a problem. It's comforting given the rest of what we've seen in Springfield. The bargain that they've come up with has been evolving, so we'll see what it looks like on Tuesday, but it involves very significant concessions on the part of Democrats, pretty major ideological concessions, and then a budget deal to go with that. And you know, so far, Leader Redonio has been eager to get this done, but members of her caucus have been very hesitant to do so, and she hasn't been able to get the votes. We'll see what happens on Tuesday. I learned a long time ago that nothing good happens when I make predictions, but what I can say is I hope we can find a fair resolution. But in addition to that, I would say this. If we're going to fix the state's budget problems in the long term in a way that's actually sustainable and fair and reasonable, we have to go at our tax system and reform it so that it can actually be fair. We have among the most unfair tax systems of any state in the country. We have a flat tax provision in the Constitution, which means that compared with most states, the middle class pay more, the poor pay more, and the very rich pay less. And if we want to find ourselves in a situation a generation from now where we've gotten out of all these awful budget situations in a way that's fair and just and doesn't go after middle class families in an aggressive way, we're going to have to fix that too.
But wouldn't this be that time? I mean, you know, not to use the old crisis creates opportunity, but, you know, as we look at how are we going to get ourselves out of this hole, which, of course, it's not going to happen overnight, and we didn't get there overnight, but isn't that the time for that discussion of a more comprehensive type of approach?
Oh, you bet. You bet. We have been floating along for generations now, unwilling to make the structural changes that are going to have to happen if we want a sound, sustainable, fair budget system. And now is the time. That to get there, we may have to make some temporary steps on the way because some of these changes require constitutional amendments. But now is the time. And as somebody who's got small children in the state, has the honor and privilege of serving in the legislature, I am judging my actions on the question of whether, when my kids are in college, we'll have fixed the real problems and won't be experiencing this type of crisis after crisis after crisis.
Did Governor Rauner, in his budget message, where he offered some parameters of things that he could accept and things that he wouldn't accept, was that helpful to the process? I mean, it's for his part, in some respects, I wonder if it's a damned if you don't, damned if you do kind of thing, only because you had some Senate Republicans saying, oh, I don't know if I'm going to go for this if he's not going to go for it. But at the same time, some of the things that he pointed out are still kind of anathema to the overall process of getting a resolution.
Oh, I don't think the governor's damned if you do, damned if you don't at all. I think he's damned if he doesn't do his job. But if he actually were to get in the game and begin leading this process and sit down at the table and try to work out a budget, I think he'd be in great shape. What he has done so far is to say, hey, number one, I want to make sure we keep on overtaxing the middle class and keep on letting the billionaires off scot-free. He said that's priority number one. Make sure our tax system stays the way it is so that people like Bruce Rauner don't pay enough and people like your typical middle-class family pay too much. And then beyond that, he's not said much about the budget. He's focused on these other issues. I would say, listen, Governor, job number one is to get a balanced budget. Come to the table, negotiate, lay your cards on the table. You're a Republican. I'm a Democrat. I don't expect to agree with you. But I think if you say what you're for and then we sit down and begin negotiating in good faith, we can eventually work something out. So far, he's not been willing to do that.
Do you think he wants a budget? Do you think he wants a budget?
I have no idea. He's not acting like he wants a budget.
Well, I mean, do you think there's speculation about, you know, this is just playing a game to see what happens in 2018. And there's speculation on both sides about not just him, but about Mike Madigan.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't know what's in his head. What I know is his behavior. And Governor Rauner is behaving like someone who doesn't care whether the state has a budget at all. He's talking about other things 24/7, and that's just not what he should be doing. His job, his first job, and his most important job is to fix the disastrous budget problem that Illinois has.
In the end, and we've already seen this a little bit about, and as you mentioned, Leader Redonio having trouble getting enough votes on the Republican side. And we know this is going to be a structured deal if it happens. But I have questions about whether those Republican votes will ever be there.
Listen, I don't know. They've not been there yet, and we'll just have to wait and see.
And plus, this is a package where everything's got to pass as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big, complicated deal with a lot for anyone in it not to like, and, you know, it's going to be a tricky thing to pass.
Well, as everybody says, the best compromise is where there's not a lot to like for either side in it.
Well, it's usually good if there's something to like.
Okay. I want to ask you, your name always pops up when it comes to issues of running for higher office, including now with as we're closing in on a year from the primary for governor. Have you made a decision about that? Are you considering it? Where are you on that process?
Well, I am considering it, and here's why. The state of Illinois is in an incredibly terrible situation now, and we need someone who's prepared to lead us out of it. We need someone to lead us out of it by laying out a progressive economic vision for Illinois, a vision that is about protecting the middle class, lifting up the middle class, and fixing the budget by going to the billionaires who have gotten off scot-free and finally, for the first time in generations, having them pay their fair share. We need someone to lay that vision out in a clear, direct, and progressive, bold way, and then use that vision to build a movement that's going to be used not just to win a governor's race, but to transform governance in the state of Illinois. And I want to make sure we have a candidate to do that. If I'm that candidate, that would be something that would be exciting and a real honor. If someone else is, that's fine too. I'm going to be spending the next few weeks working out whether I think I'm the person to lead that movement. And one way or the other, I'll be making a decision and an announcement before too long, because if we want to do this properly, it's going to require building something over the course of many months. It's not going to be quick. It's not going to be turnkey. It's not going to be automatic. It's not going to be all television. It's going to be a slow, gradual movement of people across the state, and that's what's needed, again, not just to win, but to really transform Illinois.
Well, and you've sought to do that, to kind of be a leader of that movement, trying to point out ways that Illinois could be better. I don't mean this in an offensive way, but in a cerebral way, in a more comprehensive global way than just kind of quick messaging, you know, a series of web videos. Even the super PAC that you headed, it was about building Illinois.
Well, that's right. I have been saying for years that Bruce Rauner is a terrible, terrible failed governor with a huge negative impact on Illinois. Democrats need to point that out, but we also need to say what we're for. We need to explain how we're going to fix things. We need to lay out a vision for the state that's positive, that's bold, and that people can get excited about. And you're right, I've done that sometimes with wonky, long web videos, and I've tried to do that with shorter, more punchy messages. If I were to run for governor, it wouldn't be a campaign based on 7-minute wonky videos about tax policy, but it would be based on ideas and a vision and the concept that we've got to build a statewide grassroots movement around that vision, not just to win races, but to fix Illinois.
That's State Senator Dan Biss, Democrat from Evanston, and we'll be anxiously awaiting whatever decision is ahead for you.
I look forward to that. We'll be in touch.
First, you have to survive the hustle up the Hancock.
It's going to be a long day.
Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.